From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and we'll have the latest on President-elect Donald Trump's first news conference since July in just a few minutes. But there is a lot going on today in Washington.
There sure is a parade of cabinet nominees on Capitol Hill. Alabama Senator Jeff Sessions up for Attorney General in a second day of questioning by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Elaine Chao, a veteran of three Republican administrations, wife of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, is Trump's pick to lead the Transportation Department. And the centerpiece hearing, Rex Tillerson, former ExxonMobil CEO, the nominee for Secretary of State, is facing the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and questions from both sides of the aisle about his dealings with Russia and how they would affect his role as the president's chief advisor on foreign policy. Here was Tillerson this morning in his opening statement.
Russia today poses a danger, but it is not unpredictable in advancing its own interest. It has invaded the Ukraine, including the taking of Crimea, and supported Syrian forces that brutally violates the laws of war. Our NATO allies are right to be alarmed at a resurgent Russia. But it was in the absence of American leadership that this door was left open and unintended signals were sent.
Well, NPR congressional reporter Scott Detrow has been busy. He's following the hearings, starting with the opening statement from Tillerson. Scott, Tillerson received the Friendship Award from Vladimir Putin. He's made deals with Russia. Tell us more about how, well, he seems to be going on the offense about this. Well, how did he position all this today?
Yeah, he was clear and careful to position himself as someone taking a hard line on Russia. And I think that was interesting. You heard that opening statement. And, I mean, to say that Russia dominated this hearing in the first few hours, I think is actually an understatement. It seems like almost every single question in the first couple hours was about Russia. And Tillerson was given several aggressive questions about this, and he maintained that tough stance. He said that Russia's invasion of Crimea was an illegal move. He agreed with an assertion that under Vladimir Putin, Russia violates human rights. He was very tough on that, and he said that he thinks that the United States and NATO should have been much tougher when Crimea, when Russia invaded Crimea and positioned Ukrainian military forces in response. That's something that he thought should have happened. So a tough line, but you're right that he's making those statements in response to a lot of questions about how the Trump administration will treat Russia, not just because of Tillerson's close business dealings with the country, but because of repeated statements from President-elect Trump, praising Putin, wanting to have a better relationship.
Well, also because the news just exploded yesterday that in the Friday intelligence meeting that Donald Trump had with intelligence leaders in this country, he was presented with unverified reports that the intelligence community is still investigating, that his campaign colluded with Russia and that Russia has damaging personal information about him. So Russia very much in the air. But staying with Russia's roles in Ukraine and the Crimea, here's a Republican Senator Mark Rubio questioning Tillerson about Vladimir Putin and Russia's reported record of violence against innocent people.
Let me ask you this question. Is Vladimir Putin a war criminal?
I would not use that term.
Well, let me describe the situation in Aleppo, and perhaps that will help you reach that conclusion. In Aleppo, Mr. Putin has directed his military to conduct a devastating campaign. He's targeted schools, markets, not just assisted the Syrians in doing it. His military has targeted schools and markets and other civilian infrastructure. It's resulted in the death of thousands of civilians. This is not the first time Mr. Putin is involved in campaigns of this kind.
Florida's Marco Rubio questioning Rex Tillerson there. And so, Scott Detrow, was there anything surprising, though, that you heard from Tillerson? Because while he would not call Vladimir Putin a war criminal, he did have negative statements about him.
Yeah, I think it seemed like he was just being careful there more than anything else. This exchange went on for a while. In fact, Marco Rubio was probably the most aggressive questioner of Rex Tillerson, which is interesting since he's a Republican and not a Democrat. But this went back and forth, and Tillerson said, look, I don't have a security clearance yet to see the full scope of information the United States has about Russian actions. I want to be careful about my language. That exchange ended. Rubio had questions about journalists who have criticized the Kremlin and been killed after that fact. Tillerson said, again, I don't have the classified information. And Rubio said, which is a line that's made a lot of headlines this morning, he said, this is not classified information, Mr. Tillerson. These people are dead.
Yeah.
But again, I think it was more carefulness than anything else on Tillerson's end.
We're going to talk more about that intelligence report in just a minute. But he was also asked about climate change and his stand on climate change. What did he say?
He has been kind of circumspect is the answer. The question was raised about whether the United States should withdraw from the Paris Treaty, the landmark deal that was struck where countries agreed to lower their carbon emissions. He said, I think it's important that the United States maintain its seat at the table in these conversations on how to address the threats of climate change, which do require a global response. Exxon's probably the foremost energy company in the United States and around the world. So he's been at the center of this debate. There's a lot of controversy about whether ExxonMobil was aware of the impact of climate change, you know, decades ago.
Well, they've been accused of being aware of it and hiding what they knew with consumers. There's ongoing lawsuits about that. So we will probably hear more about that. NPR congressional reporter Scott Detrow, thank you so much. What a day for you.
Yep. Thanks.
Well, in his first news conference since July, President-elect Donald Trump was asked today about those unsubstantiated reports that Russia has compromising information about him. He speculated that intelligence agents who briefed him about Russian election hacking could have leaked it.
I saw the information. I read the information outside of that meeting. It's all fake news. It's phony stuff. It didn't happen. And it was gotten by opponents of ours. As you know, because you reported it, and so did many of the other people, it was a group of opponents that got together, sick people, and they put that crap together. So I will tell you that not within the meeting, but outside of the meeting, somebody released it. It should never have been, number one, shouldn't have even entered paper, but it should never have been released. But I read what was released, and I think it's a disgrace.
Joining us from Washington is Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Hi, Rick.
Hey, great to be with you.
And a very unusual news conference with clapping from Trump supporters in the room and also an interlude with his lawyer talking about his business dealings.
I don't even have the superlative in my vocabulary to describe how unusual this news conference was for him to go to war with the intelligence agencies, for him to talk about fake news in this way, for him to still continue to not say anything negative about Vladimir Putin. And then, of course, with his business interests, setting up an arrangement that ethics experts say won't go nearly far enough and actually walling him off from it. But he is billing it as if he has gone beyond what he needs to do.
Well, and what do you think that he has done today when it comes to that story that broke yesterday involving potential information that Russia has about him, these documents that haven't been substantiated, but do you think he's put any of these questions to rest?
Fake news is what he's calling it. And frankly, because those claims are unsubstantiated, the timing and the way they developed may actually work in his favor. He's able to just to dismiss them out of hand. But he's also turning it on the intelligence community and making clear that he is upset with the way that they've handled themselves and that he is not at all impressed. In fact, he's quite angry about the way that that things have been handled with the intelligence community. And I think that response is telling in itself, even if none of these allegations prove to have any substantiation.
The initial idea for this press conference when it was first announced a while back was that it was supposed to be about him separating himself from his business interests. Let's listen to what he said about that.
I could actually run my business and run government at the same time. I don't like the way that looks, but I would be able to do that if I wanted to. I'd be the only one that would be able to do that. You can't do that in any other capacity. But as a president, I could run the Trump Organization, great, great company, and I could run the company, the country. I'd do a very good job, but I don't want to do that.
Rick, what did we learn about what Trump's going to do with regard to the Trump Organization?
No new domestic deals but that he's going to be involved in, but there is still the possibility of new deals. No new foreign deals at all, and profits from previous foreign governments under other arrangements are going to, he says, go to the United States Treasury. But the key thing here is that his sons will be in charge. So he's going to wall himself off from the information, but he's going to be essentially on the honor system here because there's no way to know what he's directing and what he's not directing. And maybe more importantly, there's no way to prevent business interests, even foreign governments, from approaching the Trump Organization, knowing that he is the president of the United States and knowing that his sons are involved in it. Clearly, he'll find out about these arrangements, even if he just reads about them in the papers the next day. So this is not a real separation from his business interests at all.
What did this press conference tell you about Trump's relationship with the press? We know he went after CNN in it, and a BBC News questioner asked a question, and he said, oh, BBC, another beauty. What do you think about his relationship with the press, Rick?
Well, it's going to be hostile. It's going to be wily and unpredictable at times. It's going to be freewheeling. He's going to do it his way. And I think he's going to clearly, he'll blacklist some reporters, as he tangled already with a CNN reporter saying that you are fake news. You don't get a question. You don't get a question. Labeling BuzzFeed fake news as well. I think he'll play them off each other. I think notable at the top of the news conference, the praise that he offered for other news organizations for not going with the story. I'll tell you, there aren't many journalists that want to hear that piece of it, but that's what he offered and said, you know, good. My respect for you went up in not publishing a story that he considered to be fake.
Rick, anything else stand out to you? We just got about 30 seconds left.
Well, I think the big thing for me is that this is someone who still has not really answered the questions about what this country is going to be like under his presidency. It's only begun. We're starting to learn just the bare bones of policy, but it is going to be an unpredictable and wild ride.
Rick Klein, political director at ABC News. Thanks so much, as always.
Thank you.
Turkish authorities are still looking for the man they say killed 39 people in that attack at a nightclub in Istanbul. ISIS claimed it as theirs on what they called a pagan holiday, New Year's. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports the violence has left secular Turks demoralized and scared.
Here's a contrast to consider. When gunmen stormed Paris cafes and entertainment venues in 2015, Parisians quickly rallied, saying the only response was to keep right on going out at night, which many did. In Istanbul, there was a similar call right after the New Year's nightclub attack. A well-known Turkish writer and actor wrote a newspaper column urging people not to get lost in despair. Go out every night, she urged, to a movie, a play, hang out at a music concert. So far, the column has drawn praise, but in Istanbul's more secular neighborhoods, the response feels more like fear than defiance. Beer Time is a bar that occupies a corner just off the city's major commercial thoroughfare, Istiklal Street. Songs from the pop charts of yesteryear are playing as bartender Salome, who like many is cautious and gives only his first name, sits down to speak with a reporter. He only has a couple tables to watch. He says in the past several years, business has gone from bad to worse. First, there were the Gezi Park protests in 2013, he says, when riot police crushed demonstrations in nearby Taksim Square. Then there was a bomb that hit tourists on Istiklal Street. After that, he says this place was almost empty. This New Year's Eve, we were actually packed, he says, but then people started getting alerts on their phones about the nightclub attack, and in no time, pretty much the whole street was deserted. Salome jumps up as a quartet of students gets ready to leave. These days, he says, it's mainly students who come here. His old regulars are nowhere to be seen, and the customers that do show up are jittery.
I think it was yesterday. A woman came in and ordered a beer. She saw two foreign guys at another table and called me over. She pointed at one and said, "Doesn't he look like the nightclub attacker?" People are starting to feel super paranoid.
President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been trying to pull a divided country together and says he won't allow terrorists to harm anyone's lifestyle, religious or secular. He told an audience of local leaders that he rose to power arguing for tolerance for pious Muslims in officially secular Turkey. And that same tolerance should extend to those with secular values.
Just as it is wrong for people who cannot tolerate the call to prayer to trample on a preacher, it is wrong to use force against those who do not pray. In Turkey, nobody's lifestyle is under systematic threat.
But secular Turks aren't so sure about that. They've been feeling increasing pressure for years under Erdogan's government. Turkey's head of religious affairs was one of the first to condemn the nightclub attack. Critics say that may be in part because the day before New Year's Eve, he issued a sermon to be read in all mosques. It criticized year-end celebrations as not consistent with Muslim values. In the largely secular Çiyangir neighborhood, home to Turks, foreign journalists, and diplomats, a young man who gives his name as Aram takes a break outside a cafe bar called Mellow. It's a cheerful shoebox of a place, but these days Aram says the mood is somber. Many of his Turkish customers are staying away, and too many of the expats who round out the cosmopolitan atmosphere are dropping in to say goodbye. I remember one Italian guy who used to come here a lot, says Aram. He's lived here for 10 years, but said he had to go home because he doesn't feel safe here. Non-religious Turks say secular values may be fiercely defended in Paris, but in today's Turkey they're merely tolerated, and then only sometimes. They're hoping the president's call for tolerance is more than just reassuring rhetoric. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Istanbul.
Have you noticed that everybody's got a cold right now, especially at the office? So what to do if you're trying to avoid getting sick? Joining us now is Dr. David Katz, preventive medicine specialist at Yale. Welcome.
Thanks so much. Good to be with you, Jeremy.
Well, and it seems like whenever one member of the staff gets sick, everybody gets sick. What's the one thing people can do to avoid that?
Well, given the fact that I'm getting over a cold right now, I wonder if there is one thing we could do. You know, the obvious one at the top of the list really would be frequent hand washing, because obviously the viruses that tend to go around this time of year are transmitted that way, and it definitely helps. But it's not perfect, because a lot of what goes around in the winter is airborne. Coughing, sneezing transmits it, and consequently, even clean hands are not a perfect defense. So I would think of this actually in two ways. One is do all we can to minimize transmission, and that's good personal hygiene, frequent hand washing. But the second is to fortify defenses within, and that's doing all we can to have a robust immune system. And two key things that I think are often overlooked there are adequate sleep and management of stress. I think we all know we tend to get sick when we are stressed out or sleep deprived, and most of us are both most of the time. So that makes us very vulnerable.
So that even if you are in a room, a conference room full of people who are coughing and sneezing, maybe your own defenses will work because you've gotten adequate sleep and you've managed your stress.
That's what the immune system's for, and it works impressively well. There are potential germs in our environment all the time, and most of the time we don't get sick because it does its job. So tipping the balance in its favor, Jeremy, is not an absolute guarantee. You know, there's nothing I'm going to say today that will guarantee you never get another cold. But absolutely, essentially having balance in your basic health and immune system responses is a robust defense. So, you know, you do what you can to minimize exposure from without. Do all you can to cultivate a robust response within. That's a powerful combination.
You know, when you go to certain countries like Japan, you see that people who are sick, who have a cold, they wear masks on their faces, which is something that most people in this country do not do. Is it something we should do?
It's not unreasonable, and you know, my kids have all been taught to sneeze into their elbows, which I always find a little bit odd, but it, you know, not totally unreasonable, and the germs aren't on their hands to spread. And actually, it does make more sense to wear the mask if you are the one with the cold, and there are filtration masks that do a pretty good job of trapping the germs and certainly limiting the spread of particles. So putting on a mask because you're afraid of getting somebody else's cold is not highly effective, and it's pretty inconvenient into the bargain. It actually is a public courtesy if you're coughing and sneezing and potentially spreading germs to contain those with a mask. So not unreasonable. On the other hand, not all that well studied in terms of how effective that is as a public health strategy.
What about people who decide to wipe down their keyboards or use paper towels to open doors?
So, you know, again, there are germs in the environment, and I think there's a balance to strike here. At some point, perfect is the enemy of good, if only because you're so busy trying to prevent infection that, you know, it becomes something of an obsession. You know, I think that gets tedious after a while. And the question is, you know, how focused do you want to be all day, every day on potential exposure to germs in order to avoid one extra cold a year? The other thing, Jeremy, is, you know, there's more and more attention to the importance of bacteria in human health. And I think sort of an obsession with hygiene takes us into the realm where we're killing friend as well as foe. So antimicrobial hand soaps and antibiotic wipes and so forth. Essentially, we risk exposing ourselves to antibiotics, putting antibiotics in the drinking water. They're already in the food supply. That has major implications for the health of the microbiome everybody's hearing so much about. And a healthy microbiome actually influences the functioning of our immune system in a way that potentially helps protect us.
And what about diet? Is there something, in addition to making sure you get enough sleep, that you ought to be eating to stay healthy or drinking to stay healthy during these winter months?
No question, but for the most part, it's the same formula that promotes robust health all year round. So sure, there are particular advantages to brightly colored fruits and vegetables that provide lots of antioxidants. Those are important to the immune system. Getting enough omega-3 in the diet is important to a balance of hormones that optimize immune system function. And avoiding things that interfere with immune responses by promoting dysfunctional inflammation, and that would be highly processed foods and processed meats and an excess of sugar and saturated fat. So, you know, ultimately you put all that together, you wind up with the same basic recommendation you would have for overall good health. Eat a diet of minimally processed foods, mostly plants, lots of vegetables, fruits, whole grains, beans, lentils, nuts, seeds, and drink water, plain water preferentially for thirst. If you get that right year-round, you simply can't go too far wrong, and it will take care of all the nutrients you need as well.
So given the fact that you have a cold, which part of your own advice are you not following?
I tend to have trouble with the sleep one. I'm always shoehorning some extra thing into my day, and I do my best to get the right amount of sleep, but it's a challenge. But I'll tell you, actually, here was the problem for me. It wasn't that I ignored any of my own advice, but you know, obviously we're just through the holiday season. I have five kids, so they all converged from all over, and several of them are in college, so you know they live in dorms with lots of other people. I mean, effectively, they are petri dishes on legs, and there's only so much you can do. So 'tis the season to share joy and love, but also to pass along pestilence. So I wound up with a cold. But you know, the good news is, of course, if you are healthy, and I am, and I do practice what I preach, you get better pretty quickly. And even when you have a cold, it doesn't feel great, but you don't get as sick as you would if your health weren't terrific to start with. But again, unfortunately, no absolute guarantee for any of us.
That's Dr. David Katz, who is a preventive medicine specialist at Yale University. Dr. Katz, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy. Take good care.
President-elect Donald Trump met with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. yesterday at Trump Tower. Kennedy is a vocal critic of vaccines. And after his meeting with Trump, he said Trump had asked him to lead a commission on vaccine safety and scientific integrity, and that he had agreed. The Trump team disputes that. Dylan Scott is Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. He's with us now. Hi, Dylan.
Howdy. Thanks for having me.
Now, the Trump team is saying that they have not yet commissioned a panel. What do we know about what happened?
It's extraordinarily confusing and unclear because Mr. Kennedy Jr. walked out of his meeting with Mr. Trump yesterday and said very definitively that he had been asked to head up a vaccine safety panel and that he had accepted that offer from Mr. Trump. And yet a few hours later, while there had been this kind of mass hysteria to an extent on Twitter, especially among scientists, the Trump team walked that back a little bit and said they were only considering creating a committee on autism. And so it's hard to know right now what's actually going to happen. But of course, this fits into a larger pattern of Mr. Trump for years expressing concerns about vaccines leading to autism, which the scientific consensus says is not true. And it's not the first time he's met with a vaccine skeptic during his transition.
Well, and remind us about Robert Kennedy Jr.'s views on vaccines.
Sure. So he, dating back more than a decade, I believe, has written about a connection that he alleges there is between a compound that used to be used in vaccines and autism. And what's maybe most notable about that is that it's sort of an obsolete theory, because the compound, out of an abundance of caution, has since been removed from vaccines. And so, you know, he's largely an environmentalist, but this has been a hobby horse of his for quite some time.
But what could President-elect Trump actually do when it comes to this issue as president?
That's a great question. So in theory, he actually doesn't have a lot of power. There's an independent panel at the CDC that sets federal vaccine policy, and Trump cannot just tell that panel what to do. The states set vaccine requirements for what kids must get. But what he could do, and the scary thing, I think, for scientists, is he obviously has a huge megaphone as president-elect of the United States. So he can use the bully pulpit to pressure the scientific community. And just by being the president of the United States and being a vaccine skeptic, that's going to breathe a lot of life into the movement.
And the movement is how big at this point? Are there a lot of people out there at this moment who are anti-vax?
That's a great question. I can't quantify it necessarily, but what we do know is there was the episode at Disneyland last year where there was an outbreak of measles, and obviously measles is one of the things that we vaccinate against and had largely been eradicated because we do. I know that there's an episode of mumps in Washington right now that, again, is something we should be able to vaccinate against, but because at least enough people are not vaccinating their children because of these allegations about vaccines, we're starting to see some diseases come back, and that's, for scientists, very scary.
That's Dylan Scott, Washington correspondent for our partners at STAT. Dylan, we will continue to follow this issue. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yoshiki is a superstar, a rock and roll icon in Japan, where he's got his own Hello Kitty brand, Yoshi Kitty. He's got his own wax figure at Madame Tussauds. He's sold tens of millions of records as the co-founder, leader, songwriter, pianist, and drummer in the monster rock group in the 80s and 90s, X-Japan. X-Japan is the subject of a documentary that was a favorite at Sundance called We Are X. As the New York Times review says, in any language, this band delivers the goods. But Yoshiki is also a classical musician, studying piano and music theory at the age of 4, composing by 10. In 1993, he released his first solo album, Eternal Melody, working with the late George Martin, the legendary producer. He did classical arrangements of X-Japan songs. In 2012, he composed the theme for the Golden Globe Awards, which appears on his album Yoshiki Classical, also produced by Martin. Well, this week, Yoshiki will play 2 concerts with the Tokyo Philharmonic Orchestra at that pinnacle of classical music, New York's Carnegie Hall. And it coincides with a vinyl release of Yoshiki Classical. So, Yoshiki joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations. Do you know there's a joke in America? Do you know how you get to Carnegie Hall?
Practice, practice, practice.
You do know it. And you have been, I mean, since a child. Tell us more about this, coming back to classical after your rock career. What made you want to do that?
Well, you know, I started playing classical piano. I mean, started practicing piano when I was 4 years old. My parents got me a piano. Actually, my father. Then, you know, my father passed away when I was 10 years old and started doing rock music. My mother got me a drum set. But classical music was always in me.
Well, Yoshiki, I want to ask you about something you've alluded to. You talked about how it was your father who got you the piano. And
yes.
I know I'm definitely going into tender territory here. You mentioned he passed. We understand he committed suicide.
Yes, he took his own life.
Yeah. Well, condolences even years later. But how much did that have to do? Because we understood that right after that is when you saw Kiss and you decided you wanted to go into rock and roll. Was there some anger there you were trying to work through? Or
yes, completely. I didn't know what to do. I was very, how do you say, depressed, crying and screaming every day. I didn't know how to deal with that emotion. But I found out about rock, so I can do pretty much anything, scream, break things.
Well, and you did. I mean, you became, you know, one of those artists. I understand that when you perform as a rock artist, you need oxygen sometimes. You know, you get injuries on stage.
Yeah, I play drums like there's no tomorrow.
Well, this is in the band X-Japan. It obviously gave you an outlet after your father's death, but also gave you this creative outlet. We mentioned how much, you know, you like Kiss. And your band became known for something that the Japanese called Visual K. What is that?
We are in crazy, crazy makeup, crazy outfit, playing something super heavy, sometimes super soft. So it's like a new kind of like movement, a new genre we created.
Like glam rock?
More like a punk rock.
Huh. And now turning back to your classical roots, what were your favorite composers? What did you like about classical?
You know, I grew up listening to Beethoven or Chopin, Mozart. My favorite composer, actually I'm going to be performing that song in a Carnegie Hall, Tchaikovsky. For some reason, I love Russian composer.
Well, let's listen to a little. Japan's rock and classical star Yoshiki playing Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake in a performance at Pace Magazine Studios. Well, I want to listen to another piece you've composed. This is the theme for the Emperor of Japan's 10-year anniversary. Just beautiful. But Yoshiki, I'm thinking, if there's anyone maybe bigger than you in Japan, it's the emperor. I mean, is there some pressure here?
Completely. I was like, whoa, what should I do? So I asked my mother, and then she said it's a pretty big honor for me to even compose a song. So I composed a piano concerto.
You worked on that piece with the late, now George Martin, you know, of course, the Beatles' legendary producer. What did he add to your music? And were you aware, you know, I'm pretty big, I'm Yoshiki, but this is George Martin who worked with the Beatles?
Completely. I mean, we worked on a classical album, so we didn't really work on a rock album. I learned a lot from him.
What did he teach you?
He said, creating music is like a painting. Like, you know, you can paint with red or blue. Red means anger. Blue could be feeling blue.
Thinking of music and colors.
Mm-hmm.
So you're releasing new classical music. You're still playing your rock and roll simultaneously around the world. This is a world you're probably, this rarefied air, you're probably a little used to at this point. But still, do you find yourself thinking about Carnegie Hall and performing classical music and thinking, oh, how did I get here? Or maybe my dad would be proud, or, you know, reflecting on this incredible career.
I'm kind of freaking out. You know, I mean, Carnegie Hall is the concert hall for, like, every single classical artist. Yeah.
So you're not being casual about it?
No. I've been practicing and practicing. I wanted to really practice on the piano on the plane, but it's impossible. So it's just, when I have a minute, I just want to practice right this moment.
Yoshiki playing Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata. Well, and what else lies ahead for you?
Well, you know, our film, We Are X, actually is going to be releasing throughout the world very soon. Also, X Japan, our first album in 20 years, is going to be out very soon. It's going to be the first debut album towards the world. Never really released an album outside of Japan.
Well, the film tells about the course of the band, how you broke up. You felt that your childhood friend that you formed the band with, Toshi, was a member of a cult, apparently, and there was a rift there. But then you have come back together again.
Yes, the story is almost like too crazy to be true. Toshi, the vocalist, and I grew up together. We met when we were 4 years old. We went to the same kindergarten. Then, you know, eventually we became pretty much one of the biggest rock stars in Japan. Then, at the heights of our career, he joined cult. He got brainwashed. So then our band broke up. Then our guitar player passed away. Also, several years later, our bass player passed away. He killed himself. So it was almost too crazy to be true story.
Well, and now back together. What do you want people to know about X Japan?
Well, I mean, you know, when people think about like Japan or Asia, they don't really think about rock band. People may think about ninja, samurai, something like that.
Right.
But there are a lot of amazing rock bands in Asia. So you want to be one of the bands to make the, how do you say, break the wall?
Breakthrough for other Japanese bands.
Exactly. I mean, if there's a boundary of the wall between East and West.
That's Yoshiki, the Japanese rock and roll icon, also a classical composer and pianist. He'll be performing at Carnegie Hall tomorrow and Friday. Yoshiki, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's take a listen to another moment from today's Senate confirmation hearing for Rex Tillerson, Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of State. The former ExxonMobil CEO was asked about climate change by Republican Senator Bob Corker.
It's my understanding that you believe human beings...
I think we should let him finish, Mr. Chairman.
Human activity, you believe that human activity, based on your belief in science, is contributing to climate change.
The increase in the greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere are having an effect. Our ability to predict that effect is very limited.
We'll continue to follow that hearing. Also in New York today, President-elect Trump held a news conference 9 days before he takes the oath of office. Trump criticized media outlets and U.S. intelligence agencies over that leak of an unsubstantiated report that Russia had compromising personal information about him. And Trump's lawyer laid out plans to hand control of his company over to his two sons and put his assets into a trust to avoid conflicts of interest. And we will continue to follow that story as well. Meanwhile, in the deep blue state of California, many farmers voted for Donald Trump despite his hardline stance on immigration. That industry relies on migrant workers. Vanessa Roncagno from Here and Now contributor KQED talked with some of those farmers as the new administration prepares to take office.
It's after 5 o'clock and dark outside when men in dirty jeans and work boots start streaming into a small record store in the city of Mendota. Racks of CDs and music posters line the walls, but nobody's browsing. The guys are in line to use the store's wire transfer service. They're sending money home to families in Mexico and El Salvador. We just came in from the fields, 9 hours pruning pistachio trees, says a weary-looking guy in a dust-covered sweatshirt. He'll only say his name is Pablo, because like all the farm workers I talked to for this story, he's in the country illegally. I ask him what he thinks of Donald Trump's tough talk on immigration. You think a gringo is going to be pruning pistachios, he says? In 17 years working California fields, he says he's only seen Latinos, mostly immigrants, doing this work. So this idea that he's taking away a job, he doesn't buy it.
We're picking strawberries that are going to go to the farmer's market.
Fruit farmer Steve Murray says he needs foreign workers. I meet Murray on his farm outside Bakersfield, where a few workers are crouched among rows of berries.
Did we finish over here, or yes, when we get a chance, we'll pull the covers over those?
Even though this area has one of the highest unemployment rates in the state, Murray has a hard time finding people to pick his fruit. He didn't vote for Trump and says his business would suffer if the new administration carries through on plans for mass deportations.
When the economy went south, what was that, in 2007, 8, 9? And jobs dried up. There were people that returned to Mexico and didn't come back. It's hard to imagine that things could get much worse.
An hour north, near Porterville, dairy farmer Tom Barcelos is feeling more optimistic. He tells me he met Trump, and he's betting the president-elect's business-friendly side will win out.
Of course, you've heard about him saying you're going to build a wall. But what he told us is that wall's going to have a door in it. And we're going to talk to the right people that want to come in and work, and they're going to have an opportunity to do that.
There's already an agricultural guest worker program, the H-2A visa program, and use has gone up steadily over the past 5 years. But every farmer I talked to complained about it. They called it cumbersome and expensive, since employers are required to pay for housing and travel for their workers. So some experts speculate a Trump administration might strip away worker protections and create a program that's more favorable to employers. Barcelo says Trump assured him people who've been working in the U.S. for years will have a chance to get temporary visas, too. But
citizenship, that's a different animal, and let's not mix up the two.
A path to citizenship does not seem likely under Trump. Not every farm worker I spoke with wanted citizenship, though. Take 36-year-old Eugenio. I meet him while he's pruning pistachio trees on a farm near Bakersfield.
tengo familia. Entonces ya junto algo de dinero, ya me regreso.
I have a family, so I make a little money, and then I go back to Oaxaca, where I'm building a house.
Eugenio says he's crossed the border 8 times illegally. But he says border security is so tight now, he hasn't been home in 5 years.
Estoy buscando una forma de cómo venir con un permiso de trabajo.
I'm trying to figure out how to come with a work visa. I'd really like that.
Then there's people like El Fego, who's working on a tree nearby. He doesn't like the idea of visas. He's been here 17 years. His family is here.
What would happen if Trump starts giving visas to people over there?
El Fego worries legal guest workers from Mexico will replace him.
And what happens with those of us who are here? He'll deport us because we're illegal.
Some worry the future under President Trump could bring more raids, or the forced use of E-Verify, a tool for checking work eligibility, or less enforcement of farm worker protections. For now, the only thing certain is that the Valley's $35 billion agricultural economy needs policies that balance the needs of both growers and workers. For Here and Now, I'm Vanessa Rancagno.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.